6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported.
Hello and good afternoon to A Public Affair. This is Andres Thomas Conteris. I'm filling in for Esti Dinur. It's a very big pleasure for me to be with this Madison audience. I am a hometown kind of guy. I lived in Madison for some time, but I live in California now. But it's a pleasure to be here on WORT. I'll say a little bit more about myself later on. But this afternoon on A Public Affair, we are have some important guests with us. With us here in studio is S. Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson is known in many communities around his incredible activism. He is most well known for having participated in the Nuremberg actions in 1987. It was September 1st when he and some colleagues were blocking a train. Brian, of course, had announced to the base there at the Concord Naval Weapons Station that he would be doing this for 40 days, and it was pre-announced and everything, but the train ended up speeding across his body and cut off his legs. It's a miracle that he's alive, given that the train first impacted on his head, and you meet very few people who have ever survived a train wreck so on their body. So, Brian, welcome.
Thank you.
Good. It's great to have you. Also in studio, we have Scott Olson. Scott is someone who came to light to the national and world community, really, when Scott, having gone on two tours of duty in Iraq, he came back to the United States and sort of had a change of heart in terms of how he wants to bring peace and freedom to the world. And he joined the Occupy movement in some way and was part of a nonviolent protest. And he ended up getting very, very serious and almost fatally wounded at that time. Scott, welcome here.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Scott and I both hail from the East Bay of California. And I'm glad to see a fellow Oakland friend here in Madison. So this afternoon we have a nice hour together where we'd like to deepen in some themes. And I'd like to start out asking you, tell us a little bit about your story, Brian. We'll start with you in terms of how is it that you became a veteran for peace? What is it that took you to Vietnam in the first place, and then you had a change of heart where you decided to dedicate your life to peacemaking rather than war?
Well, I was drafted, actually, into the Vietnam War at the age of 25. I was in graduate school, and I believed in the war, actually. In those years, I would be called a chicken hawk. I was a hawk on the war, but a chicken. I didn't really want to fight in the war, so I preferred to stay in graduate school, which was very comfortable. But since I didn't have any political opposition to the war, when I got drafted, I wound up enlisting in the Air Force for 4 years as an officer, thinking that that was going to be an easy way to get my military time in. And it just so happened that after my third year, in the Air Force, they assigned me to an Air Force Ranger unit trained at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which I didn't even know existed, that they had a unit like that. And so I was trained as a section leader of 40 men. And then we went to Vietnam in 1969. And while I was there, I was the night security commander at a small air base, and We were attacked, I think while I was there, we were attacked 17 times with mortars and rockets.
Wow. Were you ever wounded?
I was never wounded except diving into bunkers and getting water on my elbow from hitting the floor of the bunkers when the explosions were coming in. But I had another duty to assess the success of bombing missions. So that's where I encountered the incredible obsession with body counts and wiping out village after village after village in Vinh Long province where I was. I figured in 1 week I saw somewhere between 700 and 900 murdered Vietnamese, probably two-thirds of whom were small children. And that was kind of the moment at which I thought something was really terribly wrong with the way I had been raised, all my conditioning, all the BS about the war. And I raised an issue with my superiors about the calling all these civilians VC. You know, it was our term for the enemy, Viet Cong. I said they were just villagers, farming and fishing villagers. At any rate, they laughed at me and because I was no threat at that time. Today it'd probably be a treason, but at the time I was not a threat. I was just one lone voice. At any rate, that's kind of where I began realizing that I was part of a huge lie.
Mm-hmm. Even though you were born on the 4th of July.
Even though I was born on July 4th and had been such a good boy growing up.
Right.
A good student, good athlete,
wow.
Active in my church, Boy Scout, all-conference athlete even.
Yeah.
So I had done everything right, and then I discovered it was all wrong.
Right, right.
And that was just blew my mind away.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, I want to sort of go a little deeper with that, but first I want to give Scott a chance. But just so you know what's coming, Brian, you know, there are many veterans who end up, you know, turning out against the war, but the depth of their commitment to engage in peacemaking doesn't go as far as you have. And so we do want to touch on that in a minute. So, but Scott, tell us a little bit about your story. When is it that you were part of that Occupy protest, but obviously, before getting to that, tell us about how you ended up going to Iraq in the first place.
Well, I was, you know, raised in Onalaska, Wisconsin, up by La Crosse, and shortly after I graduated high school, about a month after I graduated and 2 days after I turned 18, I found myself in a Marine Corps boot camp.
And 2 days after you turned 18.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and so this was in 2005, and, you know, I'd bought the line that, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom was about Iraqi freedom, and, you know, I bought the line that serving the military is pretty much the most honorable thing, the most patriotic thing you can do for your country. And
now, had you heard that the operation was originally called Operation Iraqi Liberation? Did you know that?
And no.
And think of the acronym there, Operation Iraqi Liberation. That is exactly
right.
What it was called. And then they realized that the acronym was oil, and they thought, oh, no, it's not about oil. But, of course, it was. So go ahead.
Right. So, yeah, when I found myself in Iraq, I went there for the first time in 2006. And, it didn't take me long to realize that same point, that it wasn't about the liberation of Iraqi people. It was about the liberation of Iraqi oil fields.
Right.
And, you know, seeing that coupled with, you know, certain very traumatic experiences of, you know, seeing Iraqi policemen get killed or having friends lost their lives and cleaning up the Humvee afterwards, It was like a process throughout my first deployment that I realized that, you know, that this was at least an unjust war, and eventually, you know, turning my opinion that it was an evil war and that you can't accomplish these goals that I thought we were going to accomplish of, you know, giving them freedom or liberating them. You can't accomplish that with an occupying force, and that's exactly what we were.
So when did the sort of metanoia start to happen? That's sort of a theological change term in terms of, you know, when did change start to happen in terms of conversion?
I mean, it happened throughout my first deployment. And I wasn't sure what to do. I mean, this was 2 years into my enlistment. I had a 5-year contract. I knew I was going to go over again, which I did in 2008. And, you know, that my second deployment wasn't, we weren't under attack as much. There weren't as many bombs on the road, but, still being back there, I had to like relive certain traumatic experiences, and it kind of just made it worse. Mm-hmm. And after I got back, I kind of just did a lot of research about this lie that I had bought.
Now, this is after back on the first deployment, right? So you're talking, right? Are we in the middle of your two deployments right now?
No, I mean, I didn't bother, like, doing much research. I didn't concern myself with the politics of the war until I was done going to war.
Got
you
it.
Know, I was focused more on, like, getting through the day and getting home safely. I wasn't going to worry about the politics when I was there.
And what was it that struck you most about the political situation that made you convert then? I mean, you mentioned the oil is one,
right,
of course.
Right, yeah, and, well, just the private influence really got to me, like, how much money was being made. You know, we had contractors working alongside us doing the exact same job I did. Mm. My primary job was computer support, and they were doing the exact same thing as I was doing, making $120,000compared to my... luckily maybe like $35,000 or so per year. And you know, it was a pattern, and the private sector was getting paid on all accounts. If it's computer support, healthcare, they were making their bucks, and
okay.
and that really it didn't sit well with me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I want to open up the phones and hear questions from our listeners. This is a public affair. So let's go now to our first caller. Please, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, morning. Yeah, a good show, or afternoon, actually. But, yeah, one thing I wanted to ask about was, it's my understanding at the end of the first Gulf War 20 years ago when Daddy Bush was in, when that war was over, we left all of those arms behind. That was only a 40-day war. He won the war in Iraq in 40 days. But we left all of those arms behind. And as I understand it, the arms merchants picked them up and started brokering them around the world. Mm. And basically the strife that we see today is relative to all of the arms that were left behind. I'm just wondering whether what's going on in Syria and some of the other areas of the world are basically... due to the same thing, that
right.
the arms
well,
are being sold and,
yeah.
and brokered around.
And, of course, the United States is one of the, I guess, the largest arms trader in the world. So it's not just arms that are left behind from past wars, as you're describing, though that is, of course, a very big factor, but it's the ongoing, basically, commercialization of death. And Scott is pointing out how that in itself became a critical factor for how he saw those profiteering from death making. And so you're pointing out a very good point. Brian, do you want to comment on that, or Scott? Go ahead.
Well, basically, the largest source of profits mm-hmm. for our military-industrial complex is war making. Mm-hmm. So that in and of itself now is a huge force that owns the legislative process and owns Congress, owns the president. And they will find all kinds of ways to and excuses and threats that justifies more militarization, more Pentagon money, more weapon systems. It kind of builds on itself, and it's kind of just almost made any kind of other politics irrelevant.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. Scott, do you want to add anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, it really just boils down to violence is our number one export. Mm. And
it makes a lot of money.
It does.
It sure does.
Yeah. If we could only, you know, buy stock in it. Well, I guess you can, actually. You can buy stock in lots of corporations. But we'd rather, you know, offer buying stock for peacemaking. And in a sense, both of you are involved in this conference right now. It's the National Convention of Veterans for Peace. And we do want to say a word about that in a minute. But let's take one more caller here while we got them. Go ahead, caller.
Hi there. This is a wonderful program. I never, ever get tired of hearing the reality from the trenches, as it were. And I have a question for the guests. I would like from each of you to hear why you think this highly developed media system that we enjoy in the Western world has been so silent, and that we, the listeners, learners, need to learn it from you.
Mm.
I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you so much. Very, very important question. The question of the silence of the media in terms of these issues that we're talking about.
Well, I think the mainstream media that we all watch and read and listen to, it's an integral part of the military-industrial complex. It's what enables it to keep going. And you know, the mainstream media is what spread the lie that I bought.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
It's what spread the lie about Iraq.
Right.
And it's about controlling the narrative and about you know, putting forth their own story, and it's a story based on false premises.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's important to understand that the mass media is a corporation or a series of corporations, and they're in the business of making money, and they're in the business of making sure the listeners are going to buy the products of the advertisers,
mm-hmm.
and they get. There's virtually no money left in mass media,
mm-hmm.
very little money left in mass media for independent investigative reporting.
Right.
And so their information comes from the Pentagon itself or the government, and which we know just is one produces one lie or,
mm-hmm.
or one... one lie or deceit
mm-hmm.
after another.
Yeah,
and
right.
the media simply repeats that
yeah.
without independently reporting it
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't pay them to do that. They're in the business of making money.
Yeah.
That's what the media is
yeah.
about.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they're a corporation. They're part of the whole cabal.
Exactly. You know, there's a woman named Amy Goodman. Maybe you've heard of, actually both of you have heard of Amy, of course, because you've both been on Democracy Now. Brian had a full hour with Amy, and Scott has been on at least a couple times.
Yes.
I, you know, in full disclosure, I work for Amy Goodman, and I'm the founder of Democracy Now en Español. And we've been able to get Spanish-speaking stations around the world, now almost 500 of them, to air Democracy Now. So there's a saying that Amy really is known for, which is, it's not just about the silent majority, it is the silenced majority. And you are describing exactly the reason why the mass media seeks to silence the majority, because it doesn't improve their pocketbook when it comes to an informed citizenry in terms of what really happens with war making. And so, so listener, thank you so much for that question, because the question of alternate media then becomes a very important one. How is it that we do get to the bottom of these important issues and that we tell the public so change can happen? So, you know, and how is it really that you all not only became, you know, Veterans for Peace, but you really, really have dedicated a big part of your lives to bringing about change. And so, you know, tell us a little bit more, Brian, about the way, you know, you were involved in the Nuremberg actions, you and I really want to touch on the fast that you were a part of this past, you know, May, June. And why is it that you were fasting? So, yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, my political evolution as an activist has been part of my therapy, actually. Mm-hmm. I was so traumatized by Vietnam. And yet, I was, in fact, I became a lawyer after Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and found out that in my first case before a judge, when the bailiff said, "Everybody rise," I couldn't rise. Mm. I was like, there was something symbolically that affected me about automatically deferring to an authority figure in a black robe. It had nothing to do with the judge himself.
Huh. Yeah,
but it was a shock to me that I was so viscerally impacted that I was shaking. I was literally shaking. So I kind of started grasping that, wow, this experience has affected me in ways that I didn't even know. And so over the years in my activism with the criminal injustice system, I worked on prison issues a lot in the 70s and then in Central American issues in the 80s, I found that I was so disturbed by injustices and lies that the only way I could stay sane was to respond to it mm-hmm. with a certain, from my moral conscience mm-hmm. that I apparently had developed.
Right.
I didn't know about it before.
Wow. Sort of like, you know, Scott talking about how the war affected
him. I mean, I was from a straight family, a very conservative family, a born-again family,
mm-hmm.
Really right-wing. Yeah. And when I was growing up, I was just an athlete. I didn't, you know, that was the most important thing for me was playing sports. But I was a good enough student to always get through school. At any rate, the activism has been kind of a form of just expressing my humanity in very concrete ways to try to tell the truth. To me, that has been very important to keep me sane in an insane society. And so that has led to lots of questioning of, I mean, unraveling from the lies is just a process of constant questioning old assumptions and paradigms, and so that leads to you meeting other people, and you start having discussions about what should we do about this and what should we do about that, and the next thing you know, you're involved in at least an experiment or a practice of an expression of an attempt to educate the other people about what you've discovered. And so it's been a long process. I'm still unfolding from it all. And I did become a student of Gandhi and Buddhism in the process because I was very interested in nonviolence. I just did not want to be part of, as a white European male, I know everything, all the benefits I have are from violence. Systematic violence for 500 years, and I just wanted to renounce it because I didn't feel good about being the privileged white male that was built on layers and layers of exploitation and injustice to other people in the planet.
Right.
So that has motivated me to study.
Yeah.
Alternative ways of thinking, alternative ways of being. Uh-huh. I'm not necessarily very sophisticated at it, but it's my commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to my making decisions to go into Central America as a witness, witnessing the carnage in Nicaragua and El Salvador, usually with other veterans, and then coming back and talking about it. That led to the Fast for Life in 1986 with three other veterans.
Exactly.
And we actually thought it was a water-only open-ended fast, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four of us, three Vietnam vets and a World War II vet. And we made our wills. We actually did not even know whether we would come off the fast because we kind of wanted to see some evidence from the American public that they were going to be raising their voices in a new way in response to Reagan's terrorist policies in El Salvador and Nicaragua. So we were very serious. And we would say the country's in a state of national moral emergency, and we're responding to it.
Wow.
So You know, that's I'm not sure that what you
you're introducing a lot of topics that I want to touch on, so I'm really glad that you've touched on them. And I want to just deepen into the whole question of the Gandhian study that you did. But first, let's announce ways that people can participate on social media as well as to call in. We do have one caller that's waiting, and we will take that person soon. Please tweet us if you can at it's at WORT Talk. And you can find us on your Facebook if you send us a question to A Public Affair. I would also like to announce Brian Wilson's Facebook. You can find him at sbrian.wilson. That's Wilson with two L's, right on Facebook. And Scott is also going to give us a Facebook that we can reach him on. And also, Brian Wilson has a website. And Brian's website is brianwilson.com. Again, Wilson with two L's. So please visit brianwilson.com, and you will be able to see the learned scholar that is speaking with you this afternoon. Brian has done in-depth research, probably knows more about the history of empire than anyone I know, in terms of knowing that the United States is engaging in empire activity, and how is it that we can nonviolently face that. So I also want to announce Scott Olson's Twitter. You can tweet. You can please send him, you know, with Twitter you can engage with Scott. It's Olson Vet. That's OLSENVET. Olson Vet, and you can be engaging with him that way. We also want to touch on the Veterans for Peace Conference, but we are here on the program A Public Affair. This is Andres Thomas Conteris. I'm stepping in for Esti Dinur. So let's go back to our guests. Let's touch on this question of active nonviolence. And Brian, you mentioned Gandhi, and you also mentioned the Veterans Fast for Life fast. And I want to give Scott a chance also to comment around active nonviolence. How has that played out in your life?
Well, I guess it's sort of like coming out of the military and laying down your rifle, and still like wanting to do the right thing, because we had, or at least I had, like the best intentions and trying to do the right thing when I joined the military, and I found out later the error in that.
Yeah.
But so it's continuing with that thought process of trying to do the appropriate thing and the right thing that has larger impacts, mm-hmm. and going about it by a different way with a different story.
Hmm. Wow. Thank you, Scott. So, Brian, you mentioned the Veterans Fast for Life. That's exactly where you and I met in 1986. And Scott pointed out that he wasn't even born then. So, so two of us here are aging ourselves. But, Brian, after the Veterans Fast for Life, of course, I know I went with you to Nicaragua. I was your interpreter there, and you spoke in front of a crowd of at least 100,000, I remember, in November of 1986. And then, of course, September 1st, 1987 changed your life for the rest of your life, where you lost your legs at the Nuremberg actions. But, Brian, let's skip to what happened this year. When you heard about your friend and colleague and Veterans for Peace activist Diane Wilson. Diane Wilson, of course, no relation. She misspells her last. I'm sorry. She her last name is spelled with one L, and we are with Brian Wilson with two L's. Brian, what is it that touched you about the fast that Diane was doing that made you take a commitment?
Well, first of all, I had a long history with dealing with prisons in the United States. I'm a criminologist by academic training in addition to being a lawyer. And so I had studied the history of police abuse in the United States going back to the 1700s. I studied history of prisons and torture in U.S. prisons. That's been a common theme throughout our history. I did a study in Massachusetts in 1981 about Walpole State Prison, where I spent almost a year studying 400 brutality complaints and torture. And wrote a report about it. So I generally have this interest in realizing that prisons itself are one of the devices that political structures use to demonize the lower echelons of society as the real problem of the society, while the people at the top are just you know, robbing everything and becoming presidents and congresspeople. It's kind of what Mother Jones said when she interviewed somebody who was in prison, she asked why he was in prison, and he said, I stole two pairs of shoes. Mm. And he said, she said, if you had stolen two railroads, you'd be the president. So, you know, it's this idea, this whole class nature of our society, which yeah. it means nothing can be just, there can be no justice in a class-based right. society. Yeah. I've been following the Guantanamo situation since 2001. You know, not as much detail as some people, but it's always, of course, I've always felt of it as a medieval practice of barbaric practice. I had been also exposed to torture in Vietnam. I mean, exposed to the fact that where I was stationed, I was near a CIA interrogation center, and there was lots of torture going on there.
Wow.
Every day. Mm. And a lot of it funded by the University of Michigan Police Administration Program.
Wow.
When the hunger strikers started around February 1st or thereabouts, yes. because I thought because that President Obama, as I call him, had suspended the special office that was intended to work on closing Guantanamo.
Right.
He had closed down that office. Yeah. And so I was starting to read about the details of how U.S. military conducted the hunger strike with U.S. doctors and nurses and psychologists.
Complicit in the torture.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm a law trained person, and I thought, how can they possibly do it? Well, I know it's a lawless society, but it was so medieval that I thought, God, somebody's got to object to this. Mm-hmm. So when I read an account by one of the lawyers who had seen one of the hunger strikers and described the detail of how the force feeding was happening. I read it in early May, so the hunger strike had been going on for 2 months,
mm-hmm.
How they were strapped in a chair,
yeah.
head to foot,
right.
around their waist, chest, had a mask over their mouth so they couldn't bite
wow.
the person that was trying to get the tube in their nose, mm-hmm. and how they forced the tube down the nose bleeds, force it in their stomach, they get nauseated, and they can't do anything about it because they're totally strapped in. And I actually, when I read that account, I probably read it online in a news item on
right.
maybe Common Dreams or something.
And you read this in the month of May, probably, right?
I read it
yeah.
in May.
Yeah.
And I read it late at night. I went to bed, and I was so troubled by the imagery of
yeah.
that I went outside so I wouldn't wake up my wife because I needed to cry.
Wow.
I just couldn't imagine how I could handle it myself if I was in that situation. So I sat outside for several hours in my garden, which is a nice garden, and just thinking, wow, what am I, you know, I got to respond somehow. And I knew Diane was fasting.
Mm.
And I think, well, I'm just going to start a fast. I'm not going to start a water-only fast. This time I'm going to start a 300-calorie-a-day fast because I knew how to kind of develop a basic nutrient fast that would just keep me going for a long time. And the next morning I told my wife I'm going to start this fast.
Wow.
And she's pretty supportive of me, fortunately. She puts up with a lot with me because I'm...
You're out there.
I have a lot of emotional
yeah.
content that's constantly coming up.
Right.
And I started. I developed my routine for eating.
Mm.
My wife didn't even have to think about food while I was on the fast. I created my own little routine for my vegetables and my soup, and counted calories and measured foods out so I knew where 300 calories was. And then I. I just proceeded, and then we wanted to have it in public, so we created a public vigil, closed Guantanamo vigil in front of Portland City Hall, with a big banner, closed Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that vigil's still happening.
Yeah.
And I was
daily, right?
Yeah. Well, wow. It's Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday in Portland.
So yeah, and I was cycling from my house, which is about 6-7 miles away, mm-hmm. and cycling down every day. And then on the 22nd day of my hunger strike, I was struck by a car head-on.
Incredible. While you were stopped at a stoplight.
At a stop sign, yeah. And I was knocked off the front of the vehicle onto the pavement.
Incredible.
I was lying on the pavement for about 6-7 minutes, thinking maybe I'd broken my pelvis. Yeah. And well, I had the woman who hit me, who was appalled that she'd hit me. She actually turned the corner in the wrong lane. Into me.
Wow. So you saw her coming?
I saw her coming for about 2 seconds.
Wow.
I mean, I saw her coming, not thinking anything
right.
about it, because she would, just at a typical turn, right. I wait till the car turns. And then all of a sudden, she turns sharply into the wrong lane, and I just couldn't get out of the way.
Anyway, you were stopped. There was no way you could.
Yeah, and I was.
And you're on a hand cycle.
I was on a hand cycle.
You can't be on a regular cycle.
Right. So at any rate, after I had her call my wife and come and pick me up, yeah. I could hobble to the car, mm. and my cycle was destroyed. Put it up on top of the bike on the bike rack. And I went home and had called the vigilers and said, "Well, I'm not going to make it today."
Yeah.
And I did go down for the rest of the week, being driven down with a cane. I think it was about 6 days later, I was so destabilized by the trauma of the accident and the physical injuries, I couldn't focus on the fast.
Right.
So I came off the fast after 28 mm-hmm. days. And thought I might resume the fast later in the year. I still might.
Yeah.
It was just that. So that kind of ended my fast at that point, although I'm still involved with the Closed Guantanamo group.
Exactly.
You know, in Portland and nationally.
Nationally, yeah. Which is closedgitmo.net.
Right.
And we want to mention a number of the other long-term fasters.
Right.
Because Diane is the one who initiated this on May the 1st, and then you're the one who followed.
I started May 12th, actually.
You started May 12th. And then Tarek. But first, Brian Adams.
Elliot Adams.
I'm sorry. Elliot Adams and Brian Wilson, but Tarek Kauf.
Right.
So basically, Elliot Adams went 80 days on a modified
300
fast
calories.
With 300 calories a day. And that 300, so you really set the bar for the 300 calories, which not only Elliot, but also Tarek and Cynthia Papermaster. All of mm-hmm. these three others have taken that on. And now both Elliot and Tarek have gone off the fast. Tarek went 58 days. And Diane had gone 58 days. Diane went 57 days. And then on that 57th day, it was the International Day for Victims of Torture at the White House. She scaled the fence of the White House incredibly. And she was going to continue the fast in detention, which she did. They freed her the next day, and she ended her fast. Diane's trial, for those of you who are interested, is going to be September 5th. September 5th of this year in Washington, D.C. It's a jury trial. So Diane will be bringing up a lot of issues around why she fasted and why she's protesting U.S. policy around Guantanamo. But not only that, she's also committed to Pelican Bay, where there has been a long-term fast going on. And I mention Pelican Bay because I live in California, like Scott does. And I met with the prisoners in the shoe of Pelican Bay. The SHU is the security housing unit. It is where over 1,000 prisoners are in solitary confinement. And it's just amazing that they have been suffering torture there, because indefinite detention is torture. And when they go into the SHU, they don't know when they're going to come out. Likewise in Guantanamo. When they go to Guantanamo, they do not know when they will be released. And that is a form of torture. Another form of torture is extended long-term solitary confinement. And Juan Mendez, who's the special rapporteur on torture for the United Nations, has said that beyond 2 weeks in solitary you're already suffering torture. And so these are the themes that have been coming across with closedgitmo.net.
And force-feeding itself is
a torture. Force-feeding itself has been declared by the American Medical Association, the World Medical Association. Doctors in the New England Journal of Medicine have written about it. It is a form of torture. Why? Because it is forced in the terms of exactly how Brian described it. And you can see this visually online. If you Google Yasin Bey, also known as Mosdef, he did a very real scenario that was videoed. It was set up by the Reprieve organization in London. And he went through force feeding, and he couldn't bear it. He just started to scream and weep, and it was just horrible. There have been 5 million people who have seen this online, and please go to YouTube. Or you can actually go to the closedgitmo.net website. That's closedgitmo.net, and you can find Yasin Bey's video there. You will also find an update on all of the fasters. And so at currently, Brian, you and Diane and Tarek and Elliot have gone off, but Cynthia Papermaster continues. She's on 300 calories a day, and I myself am another faster. I have decided to, like Diane, go on water only, and this is the 33rd day of the water only fast for me. It's also the 33rd day of hundreds of prisoners in California who are in solidarity with the five core demands of Pelican Bay. One of the prisoners... Actually, 30,000 prisoners began on July 8th. It's quite amazing. One of those prisoners is already dead. And so it is a very much a life and death situation in California. And actually, some other states are participating in solidarity as well. But we invite you to go to closedgitmo.net to learn about the connections between U.S.-sponsored torture at home and abroad. Both at the local, municipal level, county level, county jails also suffer torture in that there are extended long-term indefinite detention and solitary, and as well as state prisons, other federal prisons, and we're talking about international human rights crimes that take place in Guantanamo and other black sites that the U.S. operates around the world. So, Scott, we've been talking about a lot of things. I want you to see if you want to comment on anything that we've been touching on.
Well, I mean, one thought that comes to mind is many Americans... when they think of torture, you know, they think of getting whipped or getting bamboo shoots shoved under your fingernails. But, you know, it's a broader spectrum, like these tactics we've been discussing today. And you may not realize it's torture until you've gone through it yourself or until you have known somebody who's gone through it themselves.
Exactly. And I'm glad you say that because I have known people who have gone through torture. My family. I was born here in Wisconsin in Green Bay, and then our family moved here to Madison after I started college. My mother, Ilda Thomas, some of you will know her name. Ilda Thomas is the founder of the Centro Hispano right here in Madison, Wisconsin, which has now become a very important institution for the Latino community here in southern Wisconsin. So here in Wisconsin, I was born and raised and became aware of torture when my mother's brother, his name is Iber Conteris, was captured under the dictatorship in Uruguay. My mother's family is from Uruguay. And so both my uncle, who suffered 8 years of torture and detention under the dictatorship in Uruguay, U.S.-sponsored dictatorship, of I might course. Add, and my aunt as well, my tia Susana, she also suffered 3 years of brutal torture. And so as a high school student, I was in Tremper High School in Kenosha, Wisconsin, I found out about U.S. complicity in torture. And then later here in Madison... connected up with the Amnesty International group here in the university. And they adopted my uncle Iber Conteris as one of their prisoners, and he was finally freed in 1985. And he ended up becoming a professor here, right here in Madison at the university. And he taught for several years. Then he moved on to Alfred University, then to Tucson. After 20 years, he retired, and he's now back in Montevideo, Uruguay. He's about to turn 80 years old next month, and we're going to have a big celebration for him. But some of you listening may even remember the name Iber Conteris. He became one of the most well-known political prisoners from Uruguay in the United States because 26 U.S. senators ended up signing a letter on his behalf. I would venture to say some of those senators couldn't even point out Uruguay on the map, and yet they signed a letter for one prisoner from this country that was being supported by the U.S. government, even though it was a dictatorship in the 70s and the 80s. So, Scott, I'm glad you mentioned that family connection, because it's because of that family connection that I learned about U.S. complicity in torture. And when Diane, who has been a friend of mine, and Brian started fasting, that's when I decided, you know, this fast has my name all over it. And so that's why I'm committed to going these 33 days of water only that I've done so far. But also, I'm committing to go at least 60 days on water only, which is really pushing the limits. But on that day, September 5th, which I've already mentioned, that's the day that Diane Wilson will be going to trial, jury trial in Washington, D.C., for having scaled the fence of the White House. On that day, I will go to the White House at 9 a.m., and I will have been fasting for 60 days, so I will have lost probably at least 55 pounds or so. And I will need to have nourishment, or I will suffer long-term or mortal consequences. And so I have agreed that I will be nourished in the way that they are feeding them in Guantanamo Bay. That means that they are going to use a nasogastric tube and feed me in front of the White House so that I will reveal to the world what is being hidden every single day with torture that happens twice daily in sponsored by U.S. tax dollars. That's most of the people I'm talking to right now. You are paying U.S. tax dollars. That means you're paying for torture. And so if you want this to continue to be done in your name, just sit back and relax. But if you are against that, then we invite you to visit closegitmo.net and listen to the stories of Scott Olson. You can tweet him again at Scott, go ahead and say your tweet.
At OlsonVet, OlsenVet.
Thank you, Scott. And Brian, we can visit you at your website, brianwilson.com. Mm-hmm. Again, Wilson with two L's, not to be confused with Wilson with one L, which is Diane Wilson. And also his Facebook. Say that again, Brian.
Or the Beach Boys.
Or the Beach Boys, right. So
now I think it's important for the people to understand that Guantanamo is on a piece of ground that the U.S. seized in 1898. Initially as a
during
coaling.
The Spanish-American War.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Initially as a coaling station. Yes. And it has never been with the consent of the Cuban people that the United States has this piece of land in Cuba, ever. Right. And I think it's also important that listeners know that the United States has 25% of all the world's prisoners. We have 2.5 million prisoners. There's 10 million prisoners in all the rest of the world.
And yet how much of a percentage are we? What's our percentage of population in the world?
A percentage of population is 4.6%, and we have 25% of the world's prisoners.
Incredible.
And we have 9,000 jails and prisons in the United States.
Wow.
And
80,000?
At least 80,000 in solitary, and maybe 110,000. Nobody knows exactly.
Right.
And
just like we don't know how many U.S. military bases are out there.
Right.
Yeah.
And there, when I was studying the Massachusetts prison system for the state Senate in 1980 and 81, in all of the maximum security units, which was like the SHU, the secure housing unit, usually there were hunger strikes going on in protest of the conditions, and they were all force-fed.
Right.
This was in 1980 and 81. I wrote an essay, actually became an Amnesty International report. It was called Walpole State Prison and Exercise and Torture.
Right, I've seen that.
And so it's important for people to know that the United States is committed to imprisonization of people. I mean, it does not shy away from thinking this is a great tool for repression or for... whether it's drug war or, I mean, it's basically a war on, much of this is a war on inner city blacks, but it justifies another money-making operation.
Right.
Our vigil in Portland is right next to the Wells Fargo skyscraper.
Mm.
Wells Fargo Bank was the leading mortgage, the fraudulent mortgage foreclosure crisis in 2008 and 2009, and they're the biggest investors of the two largest private prison companies in the United States,
Imagine
GEO
that.
Group and Corrections Corporation of America.
The prison industrial complex.
And then when I read their executive reports, they're always talking about we have to find ways to get more prisoners because this is the way we increase our profits.
That's it. Scott, I want you to comment on that, but also let's say a little bit about the Veterans for Peace convention that's happening right here in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a national convention. That's why the two of you are here, and that's why I'm here as well. Comment about that, Scott.
Well, we've got veterans, members of Veterans for Peace from around the country and around the globe who have come to Madison to discuss these issues and to refine our strategies and refine our tactics to commit to working for a world of peace and using peaceful means to get that.
Excellent. Thank you. You're listening to A Public Affair. We are WORT FM. It's 89.9. We are very grateful that you've joined us this afternoon with Scott Olson, Iraq war veteran, and wounded, not in the war, but when he came back home in Oakland, California, at a nonviolent protest sponsored by the Occupy movement. And you've been listening to S. Brian Wilson. Brian is also a member of Veterans for Peace, and he is someone who was part of the Vietnam War. Then became a lawyer and now is very much an activist. I want to mention Brian's book, which is called Blood on the Tracks. I encourage everybody to look it up and to read it. It tells amazing stories about Brian's time in Vietnam, but also his conversion and then the whole incident and the attack, the assault on him of the train running him over and taking his legs away. So I want to invite you to just very short final comments.
Well, I come to the VFP conventions because I consider veterans who are explicitly against war to be my tribe. Living in the United States, to me, is like living in a nightmare. So I have to have my tribes, my networks of supportive people. Mm-hmm. So I come just to meet old friends and meet new friends, and that gives me strength. From year to year, you know. Excellent. It's because it's my family.
Excellent. Scott.
And yeah, it's very meaningful for me to be able to connect with other generations of veterans. They've gone through much of the same thing, and there are many veterans here who have been activists for 25 plus years.
Tremendous.
And it's a tremendous pool of knowledge to learn from.
Well,
and we need the younger veterans.
We do.
Really.
And excellent. Folks, I want to invite you once again, visit the website closegitmo.net. There you will learn about a 2.7 million orange ribbon campaign. It's been a pleasure to be here, A Public Affair. My name is Andres Thomas Conteris, stepping in for SD Denour, and hope to be back in the future. Thank you.